Welcome to the Green Business All-Star Podcast, where we interview and spotlight green entrepreneurs and other environmental business leaders who are making a positive impact on our planet while making a profit. With your host, Anne Meador. Hello, and welcome to the show. In this episode, I had the privilege of speaking with Greg Peterson, aka the Urban Farmer. Greg has been an entrepreneur since the 1970s and has started over 30 businesses. He shares his story about sustainable living and urban farming. We talk about a lot of things, including promoting local food economies, growing your own, the key to growing local foods while stressing the importance of healthy soil for successful food growth, and educating people about urban farming. We discuss his educational platform, urbanfarm.org. So if you're thinking about starting or are already offering online courses, Greg shares a lot of insight and how to stand out in a noisy world. He also shares his content market strategies with us. We talk about technical topics too, like rainwater harvesting and permaculture, which is the art and science of working with nature as compared to working against it. Lectins, which are actually anti-nutrients in a lot of our foods, fruits and vegetables, and transforming unhealthy soil into healthy soil. Greg's journey illustrates his commitment to teaching others about sustainable living and the benefits of a local food economy. Make sure you listen until the end, where I share two green business ideas that you may want to use to start your own business or enhance your existing business. Moving forward, in each episode of the Green Business All-Star Podcast, I will share at least one business idea from the episode that you may want to use to start your own green business. All right, I hope you enjoy the interview. We have Greg Peterson on the show today. Greg has been self-employed in the green business arena since the 1970s, when he used to clean, service, and build fish in aquaculture ponds for people in Phoenix, Arizona. What drove this was Greg's realization at the age of 15 that we are overfishing the oceans. That's when he set out to change how we live and eat in the world. Since then, he's started over 30 businesses, mostly in the green arena. What if there was a garden and fruit tree in every yard? This is a question that Greg ponders every day. For over 32 years, he's created Phoenix's first environmental showcase home for urban farming. The quarter-acre yard featured a primary edible landscape with over 80 fruit trees, rainwater and gray water harvesting, solar applications, and extensive use of reclaimed and recycled building materials. 2022, Greg and his partner Heidi decided to make a big move, and they purchased 4 acres in Asheville, North Carolina, a dream that he has been fostering for over a decade. The move was inspired by the incredible local food economy in the area. In 2003, urbanfarm.org was created as an online portal for urban farming education, and a few years later, Greg created the urbanfarmpodcast.com. The podcast is designed to help fulfill Greg's passion of spreading the word about growing your own food and sharing new and seasoned gardeners' epic stories. Then in 2015, he and Bill McDormand came up with the idea for a way to super energize the local seed economy and created the biggest seed saving bazaar in the world called the Great American Seedup.org. Greg, welcome to the show.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you have quite the history here. I can't wait to dig deep and find out all about these great things that you've done over the years. Let's see, that's a broad explanation of what you've been doing for the past, you said, 32 years.
At least.
So when I just dig a little deeper and tell us more about the projects, I'll tell you from my perspective, all of this is really interesting. The Great American Seedup is, could we start there? That is just amazing because, well, I'll let you explain.
All right, cool. Great American Seedup is a yearly event that we do in Phoenix, Arizona. We rent a 10,000 square foot fellowship hall at a church and stock it with over 100 open pollinated seeds for people to come in. And basically it's a self-serve. You walk up to the Armenian cucumber bucket and we put everything in popcorn buckets with a scoop next to it. And people scoop one scoop of Armenian cucumber seeds in a bag, put a business card about what the Armenian cucumber seed is, and mark on their sheet. So it's like a bulk buy at the grocery store, but you're buying seeds. Now, the event itself is really cool, but the intent behind the event is really the thing that drives me. And that is, without local seeds, we can't have local food. And that's where the whole local food and local seed economy comes in at. I've been studying the notion of our food system for over 40 years. And our food system has problems. And what I do with my podcast and with our courses and with the Great American Seed Up is I educate people, share with people how they can energize their local food economy. And with the Great American Seed Up, it's all about seeds. And open pollinated seeds are unique in that if you plant an open pollinated Armenian cucumber and then save the seeds from that Armenian cucumber, it's not a hybrid. So when you plant that seed that you saved, you're going to get pretty much the same kind of cucumber the next year, as opposed to planting a hybrid seed where they take watermelon A and watermelon B and they cross-pollinate it. And then you have watermelon C, which is a really sweet sugar baby watermelon with a few seeds. So if you take one of those seeds and plant it in your yard, the genetics start to break down a little bit. Mm. So all of our seeds are open pollinated, and this is our, this next year, 2024, will be our 10th year that we've done the bazaar in Phoenix. It's really cool.
Wow, that is really cool. Now, I wonder, is that the Guinness Book World of Records? Could that qualify for that? Or does, or are there other ones out there that are bigger than that? Because that sounds
really
big. This
one's big. This one's big. It might qualify for the Guinness Book of World Records. Now, thank you for that. I'm going to call them and ask.
Welcome.
All right.
Let me know. Interested in finding that. So you mentioned two classes. You have the urban farm. I know you have a couple of things. I need to put my glasses on this. So it's urban... What is the name of urbanfarm.org is where you have your classes?
Pretty much everything is at urbanfarm.org. My podcast and my fruit tree program in Phoenix and all of our courses. And our courses are designed to inspire people to go out and grow their own food. It doesn't make sense to me that we don't have gardens in every yard. I was in Italy in 2004. And I was in Croatia in 2014. And one of the striking things for me in both of those countries is every single yard had a garden. Everybody was growing food. And when I walk up and down the streets here in Phoenix and now here in Asheville, gardens are the exception. They're not the rule. And so that's really what's driving me, is to see how we can get people to really start growing their local food economy. And so a local food economy is, there's six or seven parts to it: growing local food, seeds, growing farmers. And in order to have a thriving local food economy, we need to have infrastructure in place in our cities to grow our food. And so that's really what I'm all about.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's been on my to-do list. I'm embarrassed to say this, to have a garden in my yard. And I'm sure you probably hear this all the time. And it's something that I would really like to do. And I just haven't done it. My son has always been part of garden clubs at school. We say, we're going to do it at home. We're going to do it at home. And my excuse is I don't have enough space. And I think that's an excuse people use. And that's an excuse that's no excuses,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So what? I had my third of an acre for 32 years in Phoenix. And for one of those years, about a decade ago, I moved out of that house and I was looking to downsize. And I moved into a small condominium west of Phoenix in Peoria. And we had a 100 square foot back patio that faced south, and we grew a lot of food there. So you don't need a lot of space to grow a lot of food. And there's all kinds of other technology. You can grow on the ground, but there's also tower gardens, which is a hydroponic growing system. And there's so many possibilities out there for growing your own food.
Yeah, something that you said that I found really interesting is that the thing that takes the smallest space to grow is herbs, and yet it's like one of the most expensive things you can buy.
Exactly. It's crazy. And you can grow herbs.
And we all know that fresh herbs, everybody wants to cook with fresh herbs. It makes everything taste better.
And you can grow an herb, basil and cilantro, in a sunny windowsill.
I'm going to say it right now. I'm going to say it on the air. By this time next year, I'm going to have a thriving Woo-hoo! Garden that I can at least have one thing, well, herbs and one thing that I can bring in the kitchen.
Excellent. Then my work is done here.
So let's talk about your business, specifically the training portion mm-hmm. of it. I have your website up here now, and you have a nice, beautiful website, Thank by you. The way. And then you have online courses.
We do.
Which look super interesting.
Yes. So with COVID, it was barely interesting. With COVID hitting, we had to pull all of our resources in because we couldn't teach in person anymore. Now, I've been teaching online for about 12 years, but COVID really energized it. And when COVID hit at the beginning of March of 2020, me and my team decided to put together a series of classes. And if you scroll down the page that you're on there, keep going. There it is right there on the right, our Victory Garden Bundle. There are over 60 classes. And what we decided to do when COVID hit was give a free class a day for 60 days. And thousands of people signed up for it. And there's all kinds of classes in there. Then we have our other courses. We have water harvesting in depth and urban animals and growing food, the basics, and a seed saving course and one on aquaponics.
Let me back up for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you. What exactly is water harvesting for people who don't know?
Water harvesting is directing the water that falls on your property or flows across your property such that it isn't doing damage, number one, and number two, so that it benefits you. So I used to get this question all the time in Phoenix. We got 7 inches of rain a year in Phoenix. That's it. And people would say, why bother harvesting water? There's not that much. And I would say, of course, that's exactly the reason we want to harvest the water, because there's not that much. Because for on 1,000 square feet of surface area that we're collecting water on, the roof, if you get an inch of rain, that's going to be 600 gallons of water that falls on that surface. That's a lot of water, especially in the desert. So water harvesting is directing that water and either putting it in tanks or getting it in the ground where we want it. And you mentioned in my bio that we moved to Asheville, North Carolina. Now, Asheville, North Carolina, we get 3 to 5 inches of rain a month. That's a significantly different water harvesting issue. And that water harvesting issue is, what do we do with all of this water so that it doesn't flood our house? So we're sitting close to the top of a hill, but we're not at the top of the hill. And when the water, a couple of weeks ago, we had almost 4 inches of rain in 2 days. That caused some problems for us here for flooding. They weren't major problems, and I'd already mitigated a lot of them. But when I see that, it gives me ideas on how to coordinate that incoming water so that I'm putting it in the landscape where I want it, so that it's not damaging my house, my crawl space underneath. So like that. So that's water harvesting. It's just really directing the water that hits our property or is near our property to a place that we want it, so that it's non-damaging.
Gotcha. And another technical term, permaculture. You want to explain that too?
Absolutely. Permaculture, I like to call the art and science of working with nature. We human beings think we know how to do it better than nature. And my buddy and longtime mentor, Toby Hemingway, always used to say, nature always bats last. Nature will always win. So the moment that we human beings remember that we need to work in conjunction with nature rather than against nature, we're better off. And that's what we do in permaculture. In permaculture, we look to see what kind of natural systems are happening in our spaces, and then we utilize them. We work in the flow of them. We take advantage of them. So we're working in the flow of nature. And I wrote this a few years ago. This is poignant. Our downfall as a species is that we're arrogant enough to think we can control Mother Nature and stupid enough to think it's our job.
Because
we
can't. Good.
We have to work with nature. And so permaculture, all around the world, there are permaculture design courses that are happening. We do an online introduction to permaculture every December. And if anybody wants to email me at greg@urbanfarm.org, I will send you a link for the replay of our one that we did in December of 2023. It's about an hour and a half. So if you want to get a taste of what permaculture is, you can do that. And then usually big metropolitan areas have their own permaculture design course. And a permaculture design course is, there's a set curriculum worldwide, and it's usually either in person for 2 weeks or over the course of 5 or 6 weekends, and you dive deeply into permaculture. And I did my first permaculture design course in 1991. And for me, it was the realization of, oh my gosh, there's actually something that we can call the way that I think. Because the systems, the food systems, that we have in place just didn't make sense to me.
Wow, I give you such kudos for what you've done for all these years. And from a personal standpoint, you've seen a lot of great things. How frustrated are you, or are you not frustrated, just about how far we haven't come?
Yeah, that's climate grief. I suffer from it every day. I have this theory. I call it my 99-1 theory. 99% of the time people make change in their life because they get hit by a Mack truck. It could be fall down, break your arm, get diabetes, it goes on and on. 1% of the time people change because they choose to change. And it's still, unfortunately, that way. All those people that signed up, we had over 20,000 people sign up for our free series of gardening classes during COVID. And that number has dropped off significantly since the rush of COVID we're out of things on the grocery store shelves. And so people got comfortable again, and now they're comfortable and not making change.
About the business side of online courses, you said during COVID, you had a lot of people sign up, and COVID had something to do with it. But how did you get your message to people during COVID? What kind of marketing did you do?
A lot of,
or people just coming to you? Was it organic searches that were happening?
Yeah. And I have about, 70,000 people on our email list. And that fluctuates from year to year, but it's right around there. And one of the things, and I have a lot of loyal listeners on the podcast, the Urban Farm Podcast. I just put a note in the episodes, hey, we're doing this, come and check us out. And also, I ask my loyal listeners to share the podcast, share the list for the free classes. And so that's really a big piece of what we've done, is we're just encouraging our listeners to share this great free information with people.
Great. Okay. So that's the main marketing you do for your courses is through your podcast. I'm also curious, you have all of these on your website a lot. There's a lot of different platforms these days for having online courses. What are the benefits? Do you have your courses up there as well on other platforms, or just your platform? And if so, why?
So our software email marketing program is with a company called Keep. They used to be called Infusionsoft. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been around for a couple of decades. I've been with them for a decade or so. And when it came time to put courses up, they had a software for our courses that was already plugged into their system. And it's called Customer Hub. And it just made sense to put it there.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I also, when I was looking at this previously, I saw, do you have other people's classes on your website too? They're not all done by you. Are these people that work for you, or are they just outside organizations?
Most of our courses are done by other people, professionals in one realm or another. Kari Spencer did our Growing Food the Basics course. We did it together, but she did most of it. And Kari did our Backyard Livestock course. And then they get paid a royalty when I sell some. So it's set up on a royalty basis. I haven't done any courses where I purchased or licensed a course from somebody else. These are all internally produced. One of the big challenges with selling content on the internet is there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
I did my first online class. I very specifically remember this. It was the spring of 2013, and I had 20 or 30 people online in a class. And this was before Zoom. I was speaking into basically white noise. And so it's a process mm-hmm. where you have to start getting comfortable with not having feedback. I've taught live in classrooms since the early 90s. And when you're in front of a classroom or a group of people or a group of people in my living room or at the coffee house, there's interaction. I can see their faces mm-hmm. and I'll get questions from them. Not so much with the online courses. So I started early in figuring out how to present online and deliver online content. And I've studied with many people about how to be successful marketing on the internet. And for anybody looking at marketing content online, you have to be conscious and careful. A couple of years ago, I did a really big push, spent a lot of money on marketing on Facebook, got a lot of leads, and I wasn't able to convert those leads into sales. So I ended up with a net loss. So if you're looking at going into selling online content, be very clear what you're selling and then do a look-see. Who else is doing it? Because I'll tell you what, there are 1,001 gardening classes out there online. There's a lot of them for free on YouTube and on Vimeo. And so that makes it harder.
How do you think you stand out from other companies that are doing things similar?
Well, that's a good question. We do a lot of freebies. Obviously, freebies don't pay the bills. We're very interactive with people. You can see my shirt. We've got our Urban Farm Fruit Tree program. That's a local to Phoenix, Arizona education program on how to grow fruit trees in the desert. And
yeah, how do you grow fruit trees in the desert? That sounds very challenging.
Well, it's a process. There's a whole process that people can sign up. We have our extensive, we have a 40 lessons in our root, we call it Root Camp, your basic training for growing fruit trees in the desert. And that is something that we give away for free. And then people, our intent is that they come and buy their fruit trees from us. So going back to your question, the big way we stand out is we're very service oriented and very fun.
Fun. Root camp. That's
right?
Fun. That's
very
clever.
Exactly.
Instead of boot
exactly.
camp, root camp.
Yeah,
love
exactly.
it. So I mentioned earlier in your bio that your property in Phoenix, the quarter mm-hmm. acre, had 80 fruit trees on
yeah.
it. How is that possible to have 80 fruit trees on just a quarter of an acre? Are they little dwarf trees?
Kind of. They're not actually dwarf because most trees, when they're dwarf trees, they're on a dwarfing rootstock. And dwarfing okay. rootstocks don't do great in the desert. Dwarfing rootstocks struggle in the desert. So we don't bring in dwarf trees. It's really all about pruning them so they look dwarf-like.
Okay.
My front yard, which was 80 feet wide and about 40 feet deep, had about 40 fruit trees in it. In that space. And a big way that I did that was I had a hedge row of apples. I had 10 apple trees that were planted 4 feet apart down the south side of the property that separated my neighbor on the south side from me. So that's how I got 10 in. And then I had 14 citrus trees across the front of the property right along the street. So that created a privacy barrier and food. And then down the mm-hmm. north side of the property, I had another 10 fruit trees. So what's that? 10, 24, 34. That's 34 fruit trees that are basically surrounding the circumference of my front yard, creating this nice private space in my front yard. And so
I assume you don't have homeowners association
there?
That
is correct. I was in a non-homeowner association space. So that's how you do it. They call it high density orchard culture. And you can do it in, there's a notion called backyard orchard culture, where we're basically pruning our trees so that they're 8 feet tall. Because a peach tree can easily grow to 30 feet tall. And a peach at the top of a 30-foot tall peach tree is bird food. So by keeping a peach tree 8 feet by about 5 foot in diameter, you're still going to get 50 to 75 pounds of peaches off of it. And it's easier to manage. So you're going to get more and more of those peaches for yourself and not for the birds.
And those fresh peaches, something just stuck out in my mind. Fresh peaches, you described eating a fresh peach in a podcast that I heard, and you just made it sound so good.
Oh,
and the
yeah.
juice just running down yeah. your face.
So that's in Phoenix, that's called a desert gold peach. It's this particular variety of peach. And a friend of mine calls them bend over peaches, because you have to bend over, otherwise they're going to splash down the front of you. And then I just call them toe tingling. They're so good. Once you eat a freshly picked ripe peach off of a peach tree, you can't ever go back to the grocery store and buy a peach. It's just not possible. And this is the root of what I have been pushing for decades, and that is our broken food system. Our food system is broken in so many ways. It's magical that it delivers enough food in the United States to feed 330 million people approximately three times a day. That part's a miracle. But the part that is problematic for us is the nutrition in the food. And so what we're just talking about is picking a fresh peach. If you pick a peach and it drops off in your hand, it's at the peak of ripeness. It's at the peak of nutrients, and those are the best kind for you, the best for your health. What happens is if they're going to pick a peach, and they do this in Australia or South America off season, and they ship it to the United States, they're picking it when it's hard. And there are so many health problems with that. There's something in a peach in fruits and vegetables called lectins, and lectins are anti-nutrients. And these anti-nutrients negatively impact our health. And what happens with fruit and vegetables as they ripen on the vine is the lectins decrease. So there'll be less and less lectins as this ripens on the vine. And so by picking fresh fruit, you're getting the most nutrient dense. The other problem with what they call food miles, and food miles is how far food travels from where it's grown to where you eat it. And in the United States, the average is 1,500 miles that our food travels. And so when they're That's picking crazy. That peach or that tomato or that cucumber, and it's not ripe, it's not nutrient dense. Plus, the moment they pick it, the nutrients start declining in it significantly. What we're getting in the grocery stores isn't healthy food for us. And we're seeing it in obesity rates. We're seeing it in diabetes rates going up. We're seeing it in, just all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. And we're seeing agricultural lands, especially mm-hmm. down here. I'm in South mm-hmm. Florida, just being turned into housing. It's very heartbreaking. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. what's more important
That's
than
right.
food to our survival?
I believe, so here's I'm going to preach a little bit here. I believe that the single most important place that we can grow food, and this is with a capital T, is the urban areas. Growing food right where we need it. Remember I said I was in Croatia in 2014? Most people had gardens in their front yards. I saw it over and over again, neighborhood after neighborhood. In Croatia, where I was staying, was a town of about 100,000 people. They had a daily farmer's market with fresh food. Daily. And it was four times bigger than any farmer's market that I have ever seen in the United States. It was mind-blowing.
And the prices were reasonable? Because I know by us, farmer's markets, you want to go and they're super expensive.
And I can speak to that as well. You get what you pay for.
True. But when you're talking about urban areas, there's an inclination to think of lower income populations. Yep. How do we get them to be able to have the fresh food? We got to keep the price down for them to be able to have
it. Well,
I
know here in the,
Grow
here
your
in
own,
the
right?
state, they have their SNAP. It's a government program. And here in the state, they're at the farmer's markets here in North Carolina, they're doubling the SNAP money for people at farmer's markets.
Yeah. I am not familiar with SNAP.
SNAP is a government program for families that gets them fresh food. Fresh, non-processed food. Okay. So,
Interesting. So going back to your urban farm and where you are now, you haven't mentioned what you're doing on your property now, but you just moved there. Do you sell your produce, or do you have come pick produce, you pick it kind of thing, or how do you sell yours?
My property, the third of an acre in Phoenix, Arizona. I lived there for 32 years. I actually lived in Phoenix for 54 years. And it was a food forest. And a food forest is just like a forest. You go out and harvest. It's wild foraging. I remember I used the word open pollinated seeds. So what I did with my food forest in Phoenix is I would just let carrots and celery and parsley and nasturtiums just go to seed. So I'd harvest a bunch and then I'd let a bunch go to seed and they would seed themselves. So I would have wild lettuce growing or arugula or basil just that would come back year after year. So it was set up for me to harvest food out of for me and my family. So that's the difference between being a traditional farmer growing in row crops and a food forest. So we moved, my partner and I, Heidi, moved to Asheville, North Carolina, almost 2 years ago. And it was a long time in the planning for me. I wanted to go someplace quiet because Phoenix is 4.7 million people and I was right in the middle. So I wanted to move someplace quiet. And we found this really cool property about 18 minutes outside of downtown Asheville that's in a rural-ish area. It's 4 acres. And I am in the process of discovering what I'm going to do food-wise here. So we have a large garden area. We're growing a fair amount of our food during the growing season. Right now, we're recording in January, and there's not much growing out there. It's pretty dang cold outside. In fact, I think it's going to be 9 degrees tonight. And so I'm discovering a new way to garden because in Phoenix in January, that's the peak of our growing season. So I'm discovering this new way to grow here. And I'm discovering what I'm going to do next because I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've had over 30 businesses, a lot of them in the green business arena. And I'm just playing with things. So I had a woman named Samara Price on my podcast in December of 2022. And my podcast is an interview podcast like yours. And I interview people doing cool things around food. And Samara is a local purveyor of elderberry products. So she buys elderberries and she makes drinks and syrups and all that kind of stuff. And I said to her, I said, where are you getting your elderberries? And she said, I get a few here and a few there, but most of them come from Europe. And Anne's face just contorted like, what? And that was my response too. So in that moment, just a little over a year ago, I said to her, heck, I can grow elderberries. I didn't have a clue how to grow elderberries. But I said to her, I can grow elderberries. And I set out to discover a lot about growing elderberries. So in January, I bought 100 elderberry branches. They had no roots, no leaves. And I planted them in pots, and I planted them with some rooting hormone and some mycorrhiza and some fertilizers and some good things. And within 60 days, I had 98 elderberry plants that were growing nicely. And so we planted 98. I actually got a couple more. We planted 100 elderberry plants in July of last year. And by the time they went dormant, they were all 3 to 4 feet tall.
Talk about hearing about an opportunity and going for it and grabbing it.
And that's the serial entrepreneur in me. And in discovering about elderberries, one of the things that I discovered was that, guess what? Most of our elderberries come from Europe. We are significantly short of elderberry farmers here in the United States. So guess what? I'm an elderberry farmer.
I've got
100 elderberry plants in the ground so far. And the first year, which was last year, was about growing out the roots. The second year, so that's this summer, will be about growing out the shoots and developing them, getting them growing bigger. And so I'll take most of the flowers off of this year. Interestingly enough, I have a local purveyor of elderberry products that wants to buy the flowers from me. Nice. Exactly. And then next year will be all about growing the elderberries themselves. And so I'm in the discovery process of figuring out how to do that. And
there you go, listener. If you're looking for an opportunity, check out growing elderberries, become an elderberry farmer.
And I would be more than happy to share what's in my brain about what I've learned. So if somebody wants information, just shoot me an email at greg@urbanfarm.org. One of the big things, So I'm going to sidestep the business part and talk about the growing part here for a minute. One of the big things about growing healthy plants is that you need to have healthy soil. And there's five components of healthy soil. You likely have one of them. That one is dirt. Dirt is made up of broken down rock. It's high in micronutrients, but they're usually bound up in the dirt and the plant can't get to it. So in order to fix dirt and make it into healthy soil, there's one specific thing you can do. And I'll share that here in a minute. So let me share the five components of healthy soil: dirt, airspace, water, organic matter, and everything that's alive in the soil. And the cool thing about fixing broken dirt is that you just add lots and lots of organic matter. Mm. And organic matter is in the form of compost and planting mixes in the holes, and on top, lots and lots of woody mulch. I am a huge proponent of putting down 6 to 12 inches of woody mulch in areas that you want to grow in future years.
That's a lot of mulch.
But basically what we're doing, and remember permaculture and looking at how nature works in the forest, leaves fall, sticks fall, critters come along and leave a poop behind. And what you get over time is this layer of organic matter that's fallen on the forest floor that breaks down into this massively healthy soil.
That's awesome. And I think you, I'm sorry. I have no, and, finish. Go ahead.
And so adding organic matter on top in the form of woody mulch. Now, you never want to put woody mulch in your garden. You want to put planting mixes and compost in your garden, but around your fruit trees. In fact, I have a rule in my fruit tree program. Every single tree gets a 6-inch deep and a 6-foot diameter basin that gets filled with 6 to 8 inches of woody mulch, because at that interface between the dirt and the woody mulch, the woody mulch starts breaking down and turns into really good soil. For anybody that's interested, we have a series of videos on how to create healthy soil at healthysoilhacked.com. If you're interested, you can jump into that and understand how to build healthy soil in your garden.
That's great. I'm going to get that myself. And I know that's a national problem, is unhealthy soil, right? A lot of our soil is dead.
Big time.
And it's hard to grow food in dead soil. But that's for a whole nother show. That's a huge issue.
You can go to urbanfarmpodcast.com, and I have dozens and dozens of episodes talking about building healthy soil.
All right, great. So again, the podcast is called
Urban Farm Podcast. You can find it at urbanfarmpodcast.com.
Is it on Apple and Spotify all and all those other sites as well? Okay, great. And your website is urbanfarm.org. And then you have a Facebook page? Or is it a group?
I got all kinds of them, but the Facebook page is facebook.com/theurbanfarm.
All right, Greg, I thank you for your time. Before we go, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners? Any advice for somebody who's just wanting to start a business, whether that's in an agricultural field or online classes or just wanting to start a business that's going to make a difference in the world?
It's actually pretty simple. Just do it. Don't be afraid. Figure out how to start your own business. Like I said, I've had over 30. This is what I do in my sleep. All of a sudden I interview somebody last year on the podcast, and I'm an elderberry farmer. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to kill trees. You're going to have problems with your business. That's just part of it. Don't be afraid. My entire podcast is about finding people that are doing cool things and sharing their adventure. In fact, one of the questions that I ask all of my guests on my podcast is, tell me about a time you failed and what you learned from it. Because living life and running your own business, you're going to fail. You're going to have mistakes. And failure is just an opportunity to learn. That's it. So don't be afraid. Jump in, start your own business. It's pretty straightforward.
Awesome. And that's a question that I usually ask, and I didn't. So I'm going to ask you, do you have a quick example? Because we are running out of time, of a time that you failed and you just you got past that and how you did it.
Yeah. So the crux of this question is a business that I started in 2003. And I started a business in Phoenix growing locally grown organic plant starts. And I invested about 80 grand into it. And we started 100,000 plant starts the first year. And yeah, she just said, wow. Yeah.
Wow.
That's all right. And that would have been good 5 years into the business. And in January, all the plants were looking great and it was nice and sunny outside, but they weren't sellable yet. In February, it rained every weekend. So I ended up with 60,000 plant starts at the end of February, early March, that I actually ended up giving away because we had too many of them. We couldn't sell them. And so lessons for me. First of all, lesson number one is, oh yeah, I really didn't want to be in the plant start business. Lesson number two is ideally that we should have started with 8,000 to 10,000 plants the first year. We started way too big. And I should have known better, having run businesses up to that point for 22, 23, 24 years. I should have known better. And I didn't. Mm. And so even when you're at that point and you've been running a business for a while, we can make mistakes and like that. Don't let your mistakes stop you. Even if they're costly, like that one I had to mortgage my house for.
Wow, that's rough.
Well, this is part of the process. In the end, it all turned out okay. So,
and other people benefited,
exactly.
Right? As the receiver of them.
Absolutely.
All right. One last thing before we go. How about the future? I know you recently moved to North Carolina, so you have lots of trying to figure out what you're going to do there. Is there anything else you have planned for the future or goals that you're going to try to do this year?
Yeah, so I've been... I've been self-employed for almost 50 years. When you're self-employed, you work all the time. And I did well enough with my fruit tree program and the things that I did to be able to semi-retire. I still have to work. I still need to bring in an income, but it's not nearly what it was 15 years ago. And so one of my goals this year is to chill out more.
Oh, that's a nice goal. I wish that was my goal. Sounds like a great
goal. Yeah,
when
I landed here, I went through a process. It took me about 14 months. And it was a grieving process because I lived in Phoenix for 55 years. And so I left the place that I knew since I was a six-year-old. And one of the things that I had to do during this grieving process was I really relooked at my life. And looking at my life, it was like, what do I want? And one of the realizations was that I had worked nonstop for 40 years. And so it was like, all right, I just need to chill. I was paying attention to what I need. And the other piece for me is I've had businesses that are over like that. In the snap of a finger and a sneeze, the business was started and ended it that quick. And I've had multiple businesses that lasted 5 or 10 or 15 years. And I've had two businesses that lasted over 20 years each. And jumping in and just trying things is what I do. Am I an elderberry farmer making money? Not yet. But it's something to experiment with. And it's in the realm of growing food. And it's in the realm of doing something that doesn't need my full attention every day. So I'm 63 years old. In this phase in my life, it's looking to things that ease my life. You know, I'm doing more yoga and walking and running more. And I'm going to do my first half marathon in 4 years. I've done about 40 half marathons since 2004, but when COVID hit, I slowed way down on doing them. So I'm going to do another one of those, at least one this year, and take care of myself and eat well. And most of all, have fun.
Good for
you. Most of all, have fun.
And enjoy that cold weather. You're not used to it.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you again for being on the show. I really appreciate it, Greg, you and for everything that you do for everybody. And you've been doing it for a long time. And we all need to do our part to make the world a better place. And you've done it.
I appreciate it. And most of all, have fun.
Yeah, have fun. Really hope you enjoyed that interview. I love Greg's goal of chilling out more. Is that a great goal or what? I don't think it matters where you are in life. I think everyone needs to chill out more. How about you? Do you agree? One of my favorite new terms I got from this interview from Greg is climate grief. I've been in the environmental field for a very long time, and I find it really hard sometimes to believe that we're still so far behind the eight ball, so to speak, with climate change, plastics, and our standard American diet, aka sad diet, just to name a few. But on a happier note, or notes I should say, We all have the power, you and I have the power to do our part and keep working on helping people and the planet, whether it's through actions at home or starting our own business or working for one. From a personal perspective, you can help Greg's vision of having a garden and or a fruit tree in every yard or house, because there's some really cool hydroponic tower gardens you can buy these days, or start your own farm or work for one. You want to learn more about urban farming? Greg has many classes on his platform to help you get started and grow. Pun intended, listener, at urbanfarm.org. You can also email greg@urbanfarm.org to get a replay of his permaculture class for free. Local municipalities and counties also usually offer a free permaculture class. See if you can find one in your area. One thing or another thing that will forever stand out in my mind is that you can't have local food without having local seeds. Never really thought of that, but it makes total sense. Also, I couldn't believe, but I could when I really thought about it, but fruits and vegetables that we buy at the local grocery store in the U.S. travel an average of 1,500 miles before they get to us, and they lose some or all of their nutritional value by the time they get here. Greg has some awesome advice to you guys starting for people who want to start their own green business or any business. Just do it. Don't be afraid. You know, even if you fail, treat that failure as an opportunity to learn. You can also learn from one of his mistakes. Lesson learned. Make sure when you start a business that it's what you want to do, because it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of enthusiasm. And start it small, then grow it. Don't try to do everything at once. As promised in the beginning of the episode, two green businesses I want to share with you. These are things that I got out of our interview from Greg, so thanks, Greg. The first one is, you can start a business that offers existing online environmental or sustainability classes that you think are amazing. Find courses out there that other people are offering, and then approach the owner and see if they have an affiliate program where you can advertise their classes, review their classes, and get an affiliate fee for when they sign up. You can also do your own course, of course. You can also hire someone to make classes for you and host them on your platform. And then, of course, you can share the profits with them or out and out purchase them. But as anything else online, the most challenging aspect is getting eyeballs on your site, getting those people. It's so noisy out there. How are you going to make yourself stand out? Second green business idea I got from our interview, I got from Greg, becoming an elderberry farmer out of the blue. He saw a need of elderberries being shipped in from, you know, across the pond, so to speak. I'm sorry, I forget exactly where he said they were being shipped from, but they're being shipped very far away. And it seemed that everybody who was doing anything with elderberries were importing these elderberries. So again, like I just said earlier, Greg pointed out that the farther something has to travel, the less nutritional value that it has. So Greg saw the need. So now he's an elderberry farmer. So how about you? Find something that's being used as a raw material for a product such as elderberries. They use elderberries for syrup, supplements, juice, and I'm sure a lot of other things that I'm not aware of. But find something that's not grown locally that is a key ingredient in products and start growing it yourself. You become the supplier. Doesn't have to be food either. You could do it with physical materials too. All right. Well, I hope this interview has sparked an idea and a lesson or two in regards to green business and green living. You'll start your own garden, grow your own fruit trees, if that's what you want to do. Make sure to check out urbanfarm.org to learn everything you need to know about urban farming. Follow Greg on Facebook and listen to the Urban Farm podcast on all platforms, just like this one. Of course, all these links are included in the show notes for the episode, along with other resources we mentioned. And check out your local farmers market to purchase nutritional fruits and vegetables that are locally grown. Make sure you look at the stickers, though, on these products and make sure that they're actually grown locally and have not been shipped from overseas. All right. Hope you enjoyed this, and we will talk on the next episode. Thanks so much for listening to the Green Business All-Star Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you would subscribe, like, and or follow the show on your favorite podcast app. Also appreciate it if you would leave us a review to help us share our mission and the mission of our guests to make the world a better place while sustaining a comfortable lifestyle. Peace to the planet, people, and making a profit.